Blog Talk Radio.
There's a direct relationship between having the businesses and being in prison. Go find an see how many Asians you can find in American prisons. They ain't gonna be in there. But 51% of your prisoners will be black because blacks don't have any businesses and industries. There's a direct link. Blacks won't practice group economics. Blacks won't practice group politics. If you don't practice, you're setting yourself up. I told that five-story building, you're setting yourself to get wiped out. Understand the nature of race, which is economics. If you build the first floor, it's economic. Build your businesses and your industries. Control buildings and industry, and put that pulls in your money, and hold that money, and practice group economics with it. Arab and Asian money bounces 12 or 13 times for a lead. Jewish money bounces 18 times. Black folks got to learn how to practice group economics. Black Americans spend every penny they get outside their own community. Then you take the money and the wealth that you get from that first floor and go to the second floor. The second floor is politics. You then take that money on the first floor and you control your politics. Black folk must quit allowing people to tell them to go out and vote. Vote for what? Nobody's going to do anything for black folk in politics. Politics is controlled by money. Major corporations, who got the money? That's what controls politics. If you have no money, you have no say-so, you have no benefits coming. So you take your money and you control and you take your money on the first floor, you buy every politician on the second floor. And any politician you can't buy, you rent or lease them to get what you need. Then once you get the second floor under control with your politician, with your money, then you go to the third floor. The third floor then is the police department and the court system. You take your money from the first floor and your politics on the second floor and you control the court system and the police department. Then the fourth floor, then is media. You then take the money that you generate off the first floor from business and industries and you go after radio stations, TV stations, newspapers, and cable systems so that you can now inform and communicate with your own people. Right now, black folk own and control less than 35 thousandths of 1% of the media in the United States. Out of 12,000 radio stations, black folk own about 75 or 80. That's all. You own no cable systems. You don't have a daily newspaper. You have nothing of importance. You got about one black TV station. And you can't communicate with your people. You can't inform your people. You can't do anything. You can have Rush Limbaugh and all the rest of the guys talking about racism all day long and bad mouthing you. And O'Reilly, they can call black folk all kind of names all day long. What are you going to do? You can't respond. You can't even communicate with your own people because you don't have an economic base. 51% of all the prisoners in the United States are black people. You only make up 12% of the population. That's no accident. It's because you don't control the economics and the politics. And they're going to go after the weakest people they can get their hands on to incarcerate. That's the black folk. And what are you going to do in response to them when they over-incarcerate you? You're going to go out and have a march, a demonstration. We're going to march. March, boy, who cares? Marching, they never changed anything.
I got in a huge tax situation in 2008 because my divorce was in 2005 and my accountant had gotten in cahoots, and next thing you know, my accountant died and a girl that worked for him called my lawyer and said, "We have a problem." She had found on the floor all my tax forms for 7 years signed and with the checks stapled to them. So I'm thinking, I done signed and I done stapled the checks. Well, they were cashing the checks, keeping the money, and not turning in the tax form. They took the money out of the account that matched the exact, because I wasn't watching it.
So like, you could just see
600,000 deducted.
Yeah, yeah.
So I'm thinking it's the check. Little did I know, it was some people taking the money out.
For 7 years?
For 7 years.
How much money did that?
I ended up owing $22 million.
Wow.
$22 million with the penalties. So now, wow. Listen to me, man. Me and my wife in 2008, I get the call. And the way I found out was, my lawyer called me and said, "Hey, man, we got a problem. You haven't paid taxes in 7 years." Man, what are you talking about? I paid taxes. I've been writing the checks and all this here. Oh, man. He said, "This woman found your taxes in your accountant's office on the floor. Every tax check I had written and every was stapled together for 7 years, quarterly taxes, all of it. So he said, man, that's tax evasion. You can go to prison. And I said, what are we going to do? So he said, hold on, man, let me get some lawyers. So he called up some tax accountants out of Chicago. These boys was the best. And they set me down and they said, man, we got a major problem. He said, I got a friend working at the IRS. Let me take the first year. We took the first year and we sent it in. And he said, man, well, this is an old tax return. He said, man, we got a problem. He got more, but he didn't know it. And so we need a tax payment plan. So the tax payment plan was so astronomical that it was no way I could pay this. So the deal was, if you miss one payment, we come and seize all your assets and you go into jail. That was the deal. So the way I found out I was in real bad trouble was my accountants, my former manager, lawyer, got on a conference call to discuss it. But they sent out an email with the conference call number to my assistant. But it wasn't supposed to go to me. She inadvertently gave it to me. I wasn't even supposed to be on the call. So when I logged in, they were already talking, and I just didn't announce myself. And I heard them say, nobody can live under this amount of stress. There's no way he can pay the back taxes, pay his current taxes, and his living expenses. And I heard a guy on the phone say, what are we going to do when he goes to jail? And I hung the phone up. I went upstairs. I said, Marjorie, Dawson, Marjorie, we got a problem. When I explained it to her, Marjorie started crying. She sat down and cried. My wife cried for two straight days. She said, Steve, what you going to do? I said, I'm going to go to work. I took every comedy gig in this country. I signed every contract. I went to work, man. I worked every single Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. I went to every venue, the Verizon, Staples Center, MCI, Phillips. I sold out the Fox. I went everywhere. I stayed on the radio, man. I'm coming, sold out. I never missed a payment. And for 4 years in a row, I was sending $650,000 a month to the government, plus I had to pay my current taxes.
New taxes.
I couldn't get behind on nothing. And I was living. So I was credit cards, running them up, paying them off. And finally, man, in 2012, I sold 49% of my radio company to iHeart. I got a check, man. I got me a check. And then, so I paid the government completely off to zero. And that was the first time, man, I could breathe. And then the pay-per-view, I said, let me get out of stand-up, because my wife said, Steve, you finna be a major TV star. You're going to have to stop telling the jokes you're telling, because you're going to ruin your career. Because she saw the political correctness turning. And so she said, Steve, you can stop if you want to. I said, baby, I can't ever stop telling jokes. Is who I am. She said, well, okay, but you got to watch what you say. And all of my TV shows are sponsor driven, the radio is sponsorship driven. I said, man, let me get out of this, because I need time to go do more TV. And so I did one last comedy show, but I did it on pay-per-view. And little did I know, for $8, you could watch my last show. I had no idea how many people was going to tune in for that. I made a lot of money. It was the biggest single paycheck I ever made. And next thing you know, I was back.
Now learn this from Joel Osteen. That's my man. He be texting me. That's my man. This God done put some people around me, show me some stuff. He was telling this story. He said, this man that went to heaven, he was walking with Peter down this aisleway, and was going down this corridor, had a lot of doors on it, and said all these doors had names on it. And he said, Peter, let me ask you something. What's all these doors, these names on? He said, don't worry about it. Just go ahead. So he kept walking. He messed around. He saw one of them doors and had his name on it. He said, whoa. He said, hey, Peter, this here ain't got my name on it. Something I need to know. He said, man, don't worry about that. You here now. Just go on in there and talk to him. See what he said, nah, I won't know what's in the door. He said, you sure you won't see what's in the door? He said, yeah. So he opened up the door. It was a warehouse. It had nothing but shelves on it. And then the shelves had nothing but packages. And all the packages had his name on them. And he said, what is all these boxes? He said, that's all of the blessings, all of the things God wanted to ship to you. But number one, you didn't ask him for it. Then number two, you didn't believe you would have it. Then you doubted him. And then you felt like you wasn't worthy. And so now all these boxes is up here. Now the man standing there wishing he had never even been in the room. And I started thinking. I got some dudes that work for me. And I said, I want you to do this graph for me. And that's what I'm finna show you now. See, what you happen is, when God sends your package, he only sends it to one street. That's Faith Street. You got to stay in faith. You can't move off of Faith Street. You can't get on Doubted Drive. You can't be over there and start doubting it, because your package going to go right on by. You can't lose your faith and get on Not Meant to Be Way, because your package is going to keep going right on by. Because the package just go to Faith Street. You can get your little feelings hurt, I ain't worthy. Guess what? Your package going to keep going right on by. You have not because you ask not. Then you sit up here and start feeling sorry for yourself. You go on Pity Way, your package keep going right on by. If you stay right on Faith Street, don't ever come off, because the blessing is coming. If you wait on it, here it comes. It may not come when you want it, but it on time. But if you get up and you move off of Faith Street, your box gonna get sent back to sender. And now you're gonna have a warehouse with a bunch of boxes with your name on it that you didn't never get. And I don't know about you, but I want everything he got for me. If he got something for me, I need all of mine. Because I don't know about you, but God lay you out, man. God will give you stuff. Man, he done took me places I ain't never thought I was going to go. I done seen parts of the world I never even thought I could go to. He done gave me stuff. He done put people in my life. God will do it for you, man. But you just got to stay, man. Use these principles of success. Understand, God is just that way. He'll lay you out. Because if he can lay me out, see, if he fix me and change me and get me over here trying to do better, I ain't perfect. I'm just trying to do better. I still say some stuff I ain't supposed to say. You understand? I ain't got it all together yet. I just got in the gate. I'm a new kind of Christian. But ain't no lock on my gate either. So if you see, once you check me, I'm probably going to check you back. But I'm getting better at that. I don't know how to love my enemies yet. I'm getting better at it, though. But it's a process. And the more times we can make people understand that it's a process, the more people can come in. And y'all people that have been good to me, that have been praying for me. I mean, man, my mama, if she could see me now, I just wish my mama could see me. Because she's been praying for this hill all her life. Watch my son. Well, he done watched me, mama. And I'm cool now. And my philosophy is very simple. I was who I was, but I am who I am. And I'm cool with both them people. Because who I was wasn't that bad cap. I made some mistakes, but I've been changed a little bit. And it's still a process. And the more people that you invite into the process, the better this is. Because ain't nobody perfect no how. So I really appreciate y'all, man, hearing me and listening to me. I'm going to ask Kirk Franklin. See, I now learned this from Joel Osteen. That's my man. He be texting me. That's my man. This God done put some people around me, show me some stuff. He was telling this story. He said, this man that went to heaven, he was walking with Peter down this aisleway, and it was going down this corridor, had a lot of doors on it, and said all these doors had names on it. And he said, Peter, let me ask something. What's all these doors, these names on? He said, don't worry about it. Just go ahead. So he kept walking. He messed around. He saw one of them doors and had his name on it. He said, whoa. He said, hey, Peter, this here ain't got my name on it. Something I need to know. He said, man, don't worry about that. You here now. Just go on in there and talk to him. See what he's here. He said, nah, I want to know what's in the door. He said, you sure you want to see what's in the door? He said, yeah. So he opened up the door. It was a warehouse. It had nothing but shelves on it. And then the shelves had nothing but packages. And all the packages had his name on them. And he said, what is all these boxes? He said, that's all of the blessings, all of the things God wanted to ship to you. But number one, you didn't ask him for it. Then number two, you didn't believe you would have it. Then you doubted him. And then you felt like you wasn't worthy. And so now all these boxes is up here. Now the man standing there wishing he had never even been in the room. And I started thinking. I got some dudes that work for me. And I said, I want you to do this graph for me. And that's what I'm finna show you now. See, what happened is, when God sends your package, he only sends it to one street. That's Faith Street. You got to stay in faith. You can't move off of Faith Street. You can't get on Doubted Drive. You can't be over there and start doubting it, because your package going to go right on by. You can't lose your faith and get on Not Meant to Be Way, because your package is going to keep going right on by. Because the package just go to Faith Street. You can get your little feelings hurt, I ain't worthy. Guess what? Your package going to keep going right on by. You have not because you ask not. Then you sit up here and start feeling sorry for yourself. You go on Pity Way, your package keep going right on by. If you stay right on Faith Street, don't ever come off, because the blessing is coming. If you wait on it, here it comes. It may not come when you want it, but it on time. But if you get up and you move off of Faith Street, your box gonna get sent back to sender. And now you're gonna have a warehouse with a bunch of boxes with your name on it that you didn't never get. And I don't know about you, but I want everything he got for me. If he got something for me, I need all of mine. Because I don't know about you, but God lay you out, man. God will give you stuff. Man, she just took me places. I ain't never thought I was going to go. I done seen parts of the world I never even thought I could go to. He done gave me stuff. He done put people in my life. God will do it for you, man. But you just got to stay, man. Use these principles of success. Understand, God is just that way. He'll lay you out. Because if he can lay me out, see, if he fix me and change me and get me over here trying to do better, I ain't perfect. I'm just trying to do better. I still say some stuff I ain't supposed to say.
That's what you're saying.
No, that's not true. I have no idea.
We really need our own systems. And what's unfortunate...
Many a young athlete entertains hoop dreams. Few, if any, have tried as hard to make them come true as the kid our Steve Hartman has gone to see.
Every week, he set himself up for disappointment. Every week, 13-year-old Jamarian Stiles came to this community center in Boca Raton, Florida, hoping to play basketball with the other kids. And every week, he was rejected.
They'll start picking teams, and I would be the only one left out. And then they'll just tell me, just go home and stuff. You can break someone's heart like that.
The problem was obvious to everyone but Jamarian. He lost his hands and most of his arms as an infant due to a rare bacterial infection. But he insisted that was no reason to give up his hoop dreams.
What about soccer? Have you heard of that sport?
Yeah, hear it every day.
Why don't you play soccer? That just seems like the obvious thing.
You would think that I would be good at soccer. I'm really not. I'm horrible.
Which is why, on the first day of class here at Eagles Landing Middle School, Jamarian took his case to basketball coach Darian Williams.
Yeah.
Said he wanted to be on the team this year.
I said, all great, well, just make sure you try out.
He said, okay, great, but what are you really thinking?
This man has no arms.
Yeah.
How is he going to play basketball? But, man, he told me, Mr. Williams, I've never been on a team before. Even if I don't play, I just want to be on the team. And how could I say no to that?
And that's how the Eagles got their first armless basketball player. Jamarian, number two there, quickly earned a reputation as the hardest worker on the squad.
He was usually the first one in the gym, usually the last one to leave.
Still, he sat on the bench most of the season.
Try one more.
Until last month. Coach put him in the game with about 6 minutes left. And when he eventually got the ball on the far side of the court, everyone yelled, shoot it! So he did. And sank. A three-pointer. And if you didn't quite see that, don't worry. Because shortly after, he got the ball again. This time on the near side. For another three-pointer. At the buzzer. Jamarian Stiles, the kid no one would pick, was now everyone's hero. Needless to say, today, Jamarian can play all he wants at the community center. He just made the volleyball team and has every intention of playing football next year. Really, the only thing he won't play is the victim.
If I could wave a magic wand right now and give you your arms back, would you want them?
I don't need them.
You don't need them?
No.
Who needs hands when you've got this kind of touch?
That's what you're saying.
No, that's not. I have no idea.
We really need our own systems. And what's unfortunate, like when you look back historically, when great men have taken a stand to make us all strong and all come together, they were gunned down. They were assassinated because it's just so much power within the Black community that they just want to suppress it because we came over as, they say, slaves, but we were doctors. We made universities. We had the first paper. You know, we had so many things, and they just want to dumb it down. So I just don't know why we just can't come together. When we did come from the mud and being beat together on a boat together, why can't we just go together?
That's not true. But before anybody ever gunned you down, or before anybody killed any ancestor, the people that looked like you and the people that were supposed to be in your corner hated you and killed your reputation first. The only way that they're able to infiltrate and to be Why? Able to kill you and gun you down is by first killing your reputation. Even if they kill you and you become a martyr, and in a lot of instances, you become a lot greater and have a much bigger impact than if they were to leave you alive and let you fumble, right? The first thing that they ever did, and even if you go back to any of the people that a lot of people don't even agree with today, right? They're still killing Martin Luther King's legacy right now, right? Mm-hmm. Right
and letting,
now.
And we letting them.
And you, yeah. know the interesting, you know the interesting thing is about that? If you go back and you study history, most Black people didn't even like Martin Luther King. Most Black people hated Martin Luther King. Most Black people hate the very thing that is best for them in every single instance, in every single part of society, and in every single era. The very one, the one that is the biggest advocate for you, is the one that you hate first.
Yep.
They don't even have to do anything to you. It ain't them that's killing you. It's you that's killing you. We kill us first. Before anybody can ever do, say, or touch anything about us.
What's that? Aaron, damaged neural perception?
I got an understanding of why, from my understanding, from who I talk to and what I've researched on why a lot of Black people don't like MLK. It's what I was able to understand is a lot of Black people didn't want to be integrated. They wanted to be, they felt like they were doing better segregated.
That's not true. Most Black people,
I didn't say it was true or not. I said that's the understanding I got
integration,
from it.
Integration in reality. Listen, anybody can look back in hindsight and say, oh, this was bad. Fuck no. The reality is that overwhelming majority of Black people, and if you study history, overwhelming majority of Black people, integration was a choice. Integration was the option to be able to do what you wanted to do. It was to prevent you from not having to only go to this one thing to give you the option to be able to do what you. It was freedom.
Yeah.
That's all integration was the freedom to choose. What you see black people saying today, the people that argue against it, what they saying today is basically saying, listen, I wanted you to tell me what it is that I could do so you can guarantee my success. Bitch, you got more freedom today to do anything you want to do, and you still don't even go to a library. Every single library, the ones that you didn't have access to, they open and they empty. Empty. You have the option to be able to do anything you want to do right now. You can literally go to school for free. For free. You go to college and you fuck off the tuition money, and then you blame the system and say it's systematic oppression. Integration did nothing except to give you the option to be able to do even more.
What state are you in where college is free?
College is free everywhere.
If you are below a certain level and you start off at community college, and you start off at community, that's because they give you the option to be able to take it. You don't have to take it. If you are below a certain threshold and you go to community college, you can literally go to school for the first 2 years and get your associate's degree free. And then you can really finesse the system, because the way that I did it, I went to community college for my first 2 years, basically, practically free, because the credit hours were so little. And then I went and got a job, and people say, well, Anton, why did you go and get a job at the University of Michigan when you graduated school? Well, because the University of Michigan not only double matched my 401k, well, actually it was a 403b, they had the best benefits for my family. I already had a business to where I didn't have to use the money from my salary in order to substantiate myself. So then I let the university pay for my education when I went over into a major university. They literally paid for me to go to school after I graduated from community college because they was incentivized, and the university actually had a program that allowed me to do so. Now, when I get that level of game out and I give it to the Patreon members and I give it to the people that I coach and I say, listen, you can literally go through all 4 years for free, come out with zero student loans in debt, go into a STEM field, make all of the money, be able to keep all of it in, then continue to substantiate yourself by building up your 401k, by going to a public university or going into a government, right?
Because what if I just want to go into business?
But people don't want to hear that.
What if I just want to go into business?
Listen, you have the option to do what you want to do. I don't want to hear any excuses from anybody as to why they can't do the thing that they're supposed to do.
So are you saying that there was economic integration? Was there economic integration?
Yes, there is.
So integration.
So Bruce, here's the thing.
Housing integration.
So everything Anton just said, he was saying in a integration.
He was talking about the Department of Education.
Hold on. Not only can you do exactly what Anton said, go to those same places, the library, your city hall, and ask what programs that are there specifically for black people, and they will
exactly.
throw a whole book on the damn table.
I'm not denying that.
And they still don't do that.
My question is it safe to say that integration only went to certain parts of the way of life or survival? As far as there was no housing integration. There was school integration, but there was no economic integration.
I literally
what is housing integration?
Think about this for a second. Think about this for a second, Bruce.
Go try to sell your house with your
word for word. I literally gave you word for word.
See your appraisal value. Go ahead, Anton. My bad. I was answering.
I literally just gave you word for word the blueprint of how you can get a free education and get a STEM field degree.
I don't disagree with that. I was talking about people who want to just go into business.
Here's the beautiful thing about it. Even if you go into business, that is your decision. Be willing to fail or succeed based off of your own merit. Nobody owes you anything.
Bruce, what are you talking about, bro?
If you want to go into business as a black person, do you know that there are grants specifically for you to do that?
They have it for like people who don't have as much money or abandoned. They have programs for people to just do trade.
Exactly.
That's how it started, really. Like,
I'm just asking questions. I'm not trying to argue. All I'm asking is someone convince me that a black person can graduate high school and go get a $20,000 business loan before he get a $20,000 school loan.
But you don't need a business loan. And I would also say that is a bad idea, because all you still don't know how to run a business. Just because you're getting a loan don't mean you're going to be successful. You don't need a loan. We are being taught wrong. We are reverse. You're supposed to reverse engineer what success looks like. This is not it. I literally just gave people the blueprint. Listen, if you don't make no money and you poor, right? You have a better chance at being successful when it comes to college as far as funding your college and a better chance of coming out without any student loans than somebody who's solidly middle class and parents don't qualify in order for you to be able to get a Pell Grant.
Before I get started with this video, I just want to personally thank the brother Fred Hassan Powell of the Morale Facebook page for sharing this social political cartoon which is currently displayed in this video. I always big up brothers who are artists like him, my man Will James, Alex K. Art, Chris Miller, and others, because their pictures speak volumes. They don't have to say one word because, as they say, a picture is worth a thousand words. In fact, I want y'all to take a good look at this picture, which shows a brother with his hat flipped to the back telling the bald-headed brother that he's hungry as fuck. When the brother attempts to hand him his own fishing rod so he can get some fish on his own, he gets verbally assaulted. No, nigga, I want some fish. Fuck out of here with that coon shit. Man, if you look closer, you'll see that the brother that says he's hungry got a fresh pair of Jordans on his feet. And once again, I want to thank you, Fred, for sharing that photo because it is a perfect warm-up for what I'm getting ready to bring up next. Look. Last week, I had to stop past a gas station, and when I went in, I took a quick glance over to the newsstand, and I saw the Washington Post. The first thing that caught my eye was something that you normally don't see on the cover of a newspaper, which was a few straggling pants sagging brothers sitting on a stoop of a building outside. I didn't have the time to read the paper in the gas station because I had to fly, but I checked the article online when I got home, and I was just flabbergasted. I want you all to check it out for yourself in the description box. It is the December 9th edition of the Washington Post, and the front cover story is a look back at the riots which took place in Baltimore this past April following the death of Freddie Gray. The Post took the time to interview a few of the residents and get their personal take on how things have been. And has any positive change come to the streets of Baltimore after the riots? And one of the brothers that they interviewed was a young man that was out there on the streets peddling drugs from time to time. And he stated that he ended up finding out shortly after the riots that there were a few storefront apartments that were up for sale and that they were only selling for just $5,000 a piece. He then said that when he ran the idea of getting together and investing in the neighborhood past several brothers that he was out there selling drugs with on the streets, all of them told him no. And see, this goes to what brothers like myself, Sean James, and many others who are right here on YouTube have been telling y'all about this modern Negro. Okay, this Baltimore brother that was interviewed by the Washington Post had a great idea and the right frame of mind to purchase this storefront property while the price is extremely low. But the rest of the Negroes that are around him ended up dragging him into the quagmire of apathy that surrounds the Negro landscape.
She a dude. She just hit you in your face. She a dude. That bitch scared, nigga. Oh. Beat her motherfucking ass. She feel like you a motherfucking nigga. Beat her motherfucking ass.
That nigga can't.
You from New State.
Look, the main spot that this brother was looking to purchase had five rooms between both of the upstairs levels, and it just needed a little bit of furnishing. These spots could have easily been rented out to tenants or used as cheap housing by family and friends that could have worked a legitimate business out of that storefront. The Negro just don't get it, because the more legitimate storefronts, strip mall shops, apartments, and tenements you own would lessen the police targeting you, because then you could do what the foreigners and white folks that own these places do, which is hire the police to work security at your properties and places of business. Why do you think they don't go upside the heads of these foreigners? Because they step to the police officers and let them know that they have work for them. These foreigners and white folks that own and run these storefronts hire the cops, and if they don't pay them with cash, they give them free merchandise and meals on the house, so they in turn look out for them. And half these cops do moonlighting security at these places even when they are on duty, because all they got to do most of the time is just drive through with a squad car or do a quick foot patrol right near the business or apartment housing units that are being rented out. This is why they don't give the Chan family or any Chinese youngster any problems when they see them in the hood by their dry cleaners. This is why they don't bother Mr. or Mrs. Akbar or any Arab kids that they see near the gas stations they own. This is why they don't mess with Miss Yi or any of her grandkids that are close to the nail salon she owns, because they take a small percentage of the proceeds and pad the local policeman's pockets. And see, your typical foolish Negro that would challenge what I just told you will say, well, see, you insinuating that we got to bribe the police for them to stop brutalizing us. But they, like most, don't know anything about capitalism. It is a game of economic musical chairs. I just gave you the analogy when I mentioned all the foreign families that own all the storefronts, strip malls, and rental properties. Who is the only one who is left standing up with no businesses or property to speak of when the music is done playing and the cops roll through the neighborhood? That's us, yapping back and forth when the music stops and they tell our loitering asses to get moving or catch a bruising. That's us, walking around with sagging pants and glow-in-the-dark fluorescent color wigs like this sister that you see right here tossing rocks during the riot last April. Now, she's throwing rocks and expressing her anger and frustration, but she has a fresh weave on top of her head, which helped pay some of the officers that broke Freddie Gray's back. So who is the sellout and coon, black folks? And think about it. If you own some of those storefronts and control the flow of unlaundered, legitimate-made currency that comes through those areas, you can do your illegal dirt all day long without that much harassment from the local authorities. You might draw attention from a few alphabet gang organizations, like the DEA, FBI, and others, but the local guys aren't going to pay that much attention because you're helping them pay bills and you're putting food in their stomach. And since I brought up the subject of illegal activity and you pants-sagging clowns love to talk about how gangster you are, why don't you do what some of the Irish, Italian, Jewish, and Polish immigrants your dumbass keeps trying to emulate did by legitimizing some of your hustles and using the same police force that chases you around the neighborhood as a shield. See, most Negroes will try to tell you that we are always at the end of a nightstick, a baton, or getting showered with bullets just because we are black. But ask yourself a question. Why aren't that many Ethiopians and West Africans getting mollywopped and punished to the extent that many so-called African Americans are in the U.S.? Remember, they're just as black and sometimes way darker than us. But why are there fewer cases of them being brutalized and killed by the police like we saw with Amadou Diallo or Abner Louima, both of which took place in New York? Why so few cases compared to us so-called Afro-Americans? It's because they're smart enough to own businesses, restaurants, furniture stores, parking lots, etc., and pay the cops to look the other way so their fellow countrymen aren't harmed in any way. That's the logical thing to do. But you can't tell this Negro from America that, because you're still living off the backwards principle and creed of entitlement, which these liberals drafted up for us long ago. Instead of assessing this situation from a global perspective and seeing that everyone else seems to be purchasing everything around us so they can live comfortable lives and keep us at a position of marginalization as opposed to putting themselves in that boat, the Negro man and woman in the U.S. will counter it by saying, see, I object because my tax dollars pay for the police not to harass me. No, they don't, you imbecile. Especially after Uncle Sam rapes their paycheck just like he rapes everybody else's. Now, your pro-whack movement pseudo-black nationalist leaders will call me a coon for telling you this, but this is something that they know firsthand. they also know that you more than likely won't view this phenomenon from all angles because you're still under the influence of the can't we all just get along flavor Kool-Aid most black folks drank after the post-Civil Rights Movement era, thinking that all the bigotry-enhanced physical assaults and beatdowns we took during chattel slavery and Jim Crow had an exclusive cutoff date to them. Which is why every single year, one of these highly publicized police brutality incidents takes place. There's some dumb Negro that says, I don't believe that in 2087, this is still happening to black people. Yeah, it is. And it's going to keep on happening in 2088 if you don't adopt a different way of thinking, dummy. Your pseudo-black nationalists won't tell you that you are mostly to blame for this continually happening because they want you to keep feeling sorry for yourself and attend more lectures and debates where they argue over whether or not a woman is God or which master teacher's philosophy is better to follow. But I'm here to tell you right now, black folks, that we don't need to attend a gazillion seminars, travel with a million other jugheads to commemorate the anniversary of a march that never led to mass black improvement, or study the teachings of some philosophical doctor with 10 degrees to find a solution to our problem. This brilliant brother from Baltimore that was interviewed in the December 9th edition of the Washington Post, who more than likely didn't even finish high school, just gave us the answer. And if you're wondering why I titled this thing Ballin' on Baltic Avenue, I did so as a way of saluting one of my grandfathers. See, long ago when I was a very little boy, he taught me how to play Monopoly. I was about 7 years old, and I was all geeked up racing around the board to buy Boardwalk and Park Place. And he said, go right on ahead. He let me do it and said, I'll just buy a Baltic, Mediterranean, Oriental, and all these other properties that you aren't even thinking about. So as the game went on, and I only owned Boardwalk, Park Place, and Pacific, I think, he had all the other properties, the railroads, the waterworks, the electric company, and a whole bunch of hotels and houses on all of them while I was looking silly. And I ended up having to sell what I owned and wait for that $200 paycheck once I passed go. Once it finally set in that I lost the game, he chuckled and told me, son, you got to own what's in the ghetto before you walk around the block. And that lesson that my grandfather Dave, rest his soul, taught me still applies to this very day. Ownership is a universal language, no matter what culture or ethnicity you come from, because it regulates the sort of relationship you're going to have with most of the people around you.
People who live in towns and cities in Uganda and many other African countries have some access to grid electricity to light their homes and power their businesses. But many rural people aren't connected at all. But simply waiting for the grid to arrive isn't good enough for entrepreneurs like Moses Akera. He recognizes there's a good business to be made harnessing the power of the sun.
I really prefer solar to be used in the community like this because it remains the property of the clients. You don't pay bills and you don't buy fuel like somebody using generator.
So solar energy is the best option for many rural Ugandans. But being new to the industry, many solar retailers like Moses were struggling to make their businesses a success.
We don't have capacity to advertise ourselves, our products. We don't have capacity to have quality technical training.
So the Rural Energy Foundation, a not-for-profit organization, introduced the Solar Now program in 2007. Its aim, to spread the benefits of electricity throughout rural Africa by providing training and support to existing solar retailers like Moses. And they encourage other retailers and entrepreneurs to start selling solar equipment from scratch.
Most of these retailers need to be supported in terms of training so that they can be able to run their businesses better. They also need support in terms of market awareness because so many people out here in the field do not know about solar, so we need to come and enlighten them.
As well as training, the Rural Energy Foundation loans retailers portable demonstration kits, which they use to drum up business in local markets.
What we're trying to do is these people are off-grid and they do not have access to electricity. So we're trying to show them how solar can improve their lives. For instance, we try to show them how they can make money from solar. For instance, here with us, we have a shaver, so they can use this to have barbershops. We also show them how they can use it to use light at their homes. See, when you have this light in your house, the children can study at night. They can use it in their shops to work longer hours, and they can use it at home.
If retailers want to use the Solar Now brand, they have to commit to providing high-quality installations and good after-sales service. The Rural Energy Foundation helps them achieve this by training solar technicians.
We're trying to get the entrepreneurs to sign service contracts, so when they sell the product, it also comes with after-sales service. Let's say they have to check to make a phone call to the customer after a certain period to check if the system is working. And then till after some time through the service contract, they also have to go and actually do the inspection of the system.
The Rural Energy Foundation has trained over 200 retailers in 9 African countries. So far, they've sold 57,000 solar home systems and 36,000 solar lanterns. They've helped at least 400,000 people, saved nearly 5 million litres of kerosene and 12,000 tons of CO2 each year. Basil Okelo is impressed and has decided to buy the equipment from Moses to set up his own solar barbershop and phone charging business. He's taking advantage of a credit scheme which helps entrepreneurs buy equipment from Solar Now retailers to get their businesses going.
Solar Now is giving me a loan. I'm going to make a down payment of 25% now. Later, in 3 months' time, I'll make another 25%, making a total of 50%. Then the remaining I'll complete within a period of a year.
With his system now installed, Basil is optimistic about the future.
Because this is a new investment I'm going into. I have never been into this business before. But as I see, I have the expectation that I'll make money.
Moses is growing his solar retail business too. He already had a shop in town. With support from the Rural Energy Foundation, he's now set up a small village branch to cater specifically for his rural customers.
Rural Energy Foundation is very important to us. If they help us training technician, we shall be in position to expand all over.
We hope that others will also adopt the private sector development approach. We don't want to be unique. We want to spread the word that this is a really efficient approach to get the technology diffused deeply into the rural markets.
The Rural Energy Foundation plans to expand into other African countries and broaden its range of sustainable technologies. Solar panels are now becoming a common sight here on homes, and shops buy them as well to run radios and offer phone charging, increasing their income and enabling people to communicate. And to everyone's delight, the local bar has installed a fridge powered by the sun. The owner is pleased with his investment.
Yeah, we're happy. Of course, it's cold. The beer tastes better. And so I get more customers. We'll be right back.
Valerie, how did you learn that your boy had died?
Well, my daughter, first of all, she's on Facebook or whatever, and she saw the live streaming of the actual event. I, on the other hand, I didn't know what was going on. I just heard her screaming and hollering through the house, and I was like, what's going on? What's going on? And she was like, my brother's dying. My brother's been shot. Oh, my God. He's on Facebook. He's dying. And I'm like, what are you talking about? So I immediately jumped up, and we just headed out the door. And I'm like, where are they? Where are they? And we really couldn't get a fix on it until she said that it was a sign that stated Falcon Heights, you know, like entry into that little area. And I said, no, I know exactly where I'm going. And we arrived on a scene, and it was cordoned off, and the police, you know, they were of really no assistance to me because, first of all, they didn't know where he was, what hospital, because I was adamant about being with my son because I did not want my son to die by himself.
Forgive me interrupting, but did you ever talk to your son about how to behave, if ever in contact with the police?
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's really a shame that we as African-American people, we have to have that talk with our sons and our daughters as to if you're approached by the police, don't say anything. Do exactly what they ask you to do. Just comply. Comply, comply, comply. Because it has gotten to the point where this is a routine thing. Black people getting killed by a police officer and there's no consequences. No one is held accountable. But I had that talk with my son. Yes, I did.
Right.
Now, often.
Let me
often.
Just talk now to your lawyer for a moment. Judge Glenda Hatchett, you're going to fight this case. What real chance?
Absolutely.
What real chance is that there will be justice? And what chance is there even that there will even be a trial?
Well, let me first of all explain that I will not have the responsibility for prosecuting the police officers. I am representing the family on the civil side, but I am doing everything I can to urge that there be a special prosecutor on behalf of the family. I've already made those formal requests. We will be making a formal request to the Department of Justice with the U.S. Attorney General because we want all eyes on this case. I have to explain that this is a man who was employed, who was loved by his family, adored by the community, who all of his coworkers, all of the children loved him. He had no felony record. He was not combative. He was not fleeing from the police. He was still in his seatbelt when he was shot. He was permitted to have, he had a legal permit to have a gun. And so if this happens to someone who is in full compliance, how can it possibly be justified? And I am going to do everything in my power to raise the level of consciousness and visibility on this case, and we are going to be insisting that the prosecutor proceed vigorously on this case.
Right.
There is no other alternative.
Let me just come back to you in a moment, go back to Valerie. Valerie, you must have been buoyed by what you saw on the platform of the Democrat convention, because it seems that the Democratic Party and its candidate are determined somehow to rectify this desperate imbalance.
Yes, it needs to stop because we cannot coexist with this type of behavior. There needs to be accountability. It just can't continue to go on like this because you don't know how it's going to end. It may not end well because you have, on the other hand, people who are supposed to protect and serve you, and they're the ones that's actually committing crimes legally. Mm-hmm. and it has to stop. There has to be accountability.
Right.
This type of behavior shouldn't be going on with our police officers.
Valerie, let me ask your judge friend, Glenda. Judge, what chance do you really think that the establishment, and you're talking to the establishment, you're talking to the Justice Department, what chance they will comply and provide a special prosecutor and answer the requests you're making?
Well, I am very hopeful. And the reason that I am representing the Castile family is because I hope to use the credibility that I have nationally, and I am going to vigorously pursue this. We have asked not only the local district attorney, we've asked the state attorney general and the governor, all in a very formalized request for a special prosecutor.
Right.
There is enough for the Justice Department to come in and do a separate investigation of practices.
Right.
And what we believe has been a history of profiling African-American citizens in
Judge,
this community.
Judge
so
Glenda
I operate from the side of hope, and we are going to work vigorously to make sure that this time
right.
is different.
Judge, thank you very, very much indeed for joining us. And Valerie Castile, thank you very much. And commiserations and... May you reach peace. Thank you very much.
In July, we brought you a story about poverty in Alabama, which was spurred by a report from the United Nations Special Rapporteur on Extreme Poverty and Human Rights, Philip Alston. Alston toured America, spotlighting third world-style poverty in our first world country. NewsHour Weekend Special Correspondent Simon Ostrowski continues following in Alston's footsteps with a report on poverty in Los Angeles. Supported in part by a grant from the Pulitzer Center on Crisis Reporting, this report is part of our ongoing series about poverty and opportunity in America, Chasing the Dream.
Los Angeles, the home of some of the most desirable zip codes in the country. But right at the heart of this wealthy metropolis exist conditions that have been described by the city's own newspaper, the Los Angeles Times, as a national disgrace. One expanse of 50 city blocks is an area that's become synonymous with poverty, crime, and homelessness. It's existed for decades and has dogged successive mayoral administrations that have tried to eradicate it. It's called Skid Row, and is home to an estimated 2,000 members of Los Angeles County's homeless community.
LA has one of the highest rents in the nation. And the reason why come there's so many tents out here is because people can't afford to live in a house.
Steve Richardson, who goes by the name General Dogon, is an activist at the LA Community Action Network, which advocates for the city's homeless community.
The majority of the people that you see sleeping on the streets are black, and these are folks that have fell through the poverty level. It makes me really mad.
Long the subject of local and national concern, Skid Row recently garnered international attention when it became the focus of a report written by the United Nations Rapporteur on Extreme Poverty, Philip Alston, whose job more often involves assessing conditions in the developing world.
The homelessness on the streets in LA is pretty staggering in terms of magnitude, in terms of how long running it is. There is a chronic shortage of affordable housing.
Nationally, homelessness has been mostly on the decline since 2010, though it ticked upward slightly in 2017 to nearly 554,000 people without their own roof over their heads in a so-called point-in-time count. The Los Angeles area, meanwhile, has trended in the opposite direction, as the cost of living here soared over the last decade, forcing thousands onto the street in what has amounted to a nearly 50% increase in homelessness since 2012 to almost 53,000 people. The sheer size of Skid Row makes it look like a refugee camp. But according to a 2017 report by several homelessness advocacy groups, the availability of toilets here is worse than in a UN-run Syrian refugee camp.
It smells of urine everywhere. Skid Row had about 10 toilets, I think, for thousands of people. So it's a pretty bad setup.
So this is, call it the Big Green Machine. And it's a bathroom.
According to the LA Community Action Network, nearly 1,800 unsheltered people in Skid Row share access to just 9 toilets like this one, which means many avoid them altogether and use buckets, which are then emptied into the streets and trash cans.
and that was PTSD, but I didn't know nothing about that.
Willie Van Seals is a Vietnam vet suffering from heroin addiction, one of almost 3,900 homeless veterans in L.A. County.
I'll show you. The buckets that we use are urinate, bowel movement. There's nowhere around here to use the bathroom. And that's hard on a person. You know what I mean? Especially you got to walk around and find somewhere to take a crap. Yeah. Come on now.
The authorities know hygiene is an issue here. The county health department reported that its teams observed feces and urine on 8 of 10 sidewalks during a survey back in 2012. Street washes like this one have been instituted to help stop the spread of disease.
If we don't power wash the streets, we end up with what we had years ago when we had a tuberculosis outbreak or hepatitis outbreak or some kind of disease. It has to be done. It has to be done.
Officer Dion Joseph has been patrolling the streets of Skid Row for close to two decades. He says he's seen well-meaning policies to improve health conditions backfire.
Years ago, we had 27 porta potties in Skid Row. My concern was that they would be taken over by the criminal element. And day one, that's exactly what happened. When those bathrooms were here, gangsters were charging the homeless $1 to $5 to use the porta potties for what they were designed for.
While we're with him, Officer Joseph receives a complaint.
I've got these people who pulled up in front of the doorway. I've asked them repeatedly to move. And trying to have a rational conversation with the irrational people, I just don't want to do it.
How are you? I'm sorry to bother you. There's a gentleman here who has a business, and the law says you can't be within 10 feet of his doorway. Can you guys move about 10 feet this way so we can have his space?
He resolves the situation without incident. But the UN report points to data from the LA Times showing that 14,000 homeless people were arrested in LA in 2016, a 31% increase since 2011. The report encouraged authorities to shift from a criminal justice response to a human rights-centered response to homelessness.
Homelessness is being criminalized in many ways, and it's as though you sort of keep moving the pieces around the chessboard and suddenly it's going to improve. Instead of saying, okay, we actually need to work out how to create places where these people can go.
I agree with the UN. We shouldn't be the tip of the spear. Fix the system, especially in places like Skid Row, where many individuals struggle with dual diagnosis, where they're addicts and mentally ill. We don't want to be the tip of the spear, but we have to be until a solution's arrived.
According to Victor Hinderleiter of the Los Angeles Homeless Services Authority, mental health and addiction are a huge factor contributing to homelessness.
Approximately 30% of people experiencing homelessness self-report that they have a severe mental health disorder. About 30% of people experiencing homelessness self-report that they have a substance use disorder. Homelessness, in and of itself, is a traumatic experience.
Christina Miller, the LA Mayor's Senior Project Manager of Homeless Strategies, agrees that addressing homelessness is a multi-tiered process, but disagrees that the homeless are being criminalized.
And instead of leading with police, leading with enforcement, we are doing everything we can to lead with services, because we know that police officers are not social workers. That is not necessarily in their purview, and having an enforcement-heavy response is not ultimately going to get people off the streets.
Activists say they know what will get people off the streets.
The solution is simple. This is what the solution is. This is the only thing that ends homelessness, is this right here, house keys. And until everybody got them, hey, you got to be good neighbors, because there's going to be people sleeping on the streets.
There are a lot of solutions that we are focusing on currently in terms of trying to expand our interim shelter bed capacity. But we also know what the only solution is to homelessness, which is permanent housing.
Miller told NewsHour Weekend the city of L.A. had embarked on an unprecedented drive to build 10,000 units of housing for the chronically homeless, those who've repeatedly ended up on the streets or been there for at least a year. It's funded through a $1.2 billion city bond over the next 10 years. That's in addition to a $30 million bridge home program directed at providing interim housing in the meantime. And the efforts may have started to pay off. This year, the homeless count in L.A. County went down for the first time since 2014, only modestly, from 55,000 people to just under 53,000, but it bucks a six-year-long trend in the opposite direction.
We are cautiously optimistic. We are celebrating the fact that there seems to be a change in the direction of the trajectory, and it does tell us that we're doing something right.
Well, they were considerate enough to give us a pantry.
Jose Soto, another veteran, is one of the lucky ones who's recently been housed after years in and out of prison in Skid Row.
I'm really happy with the closet space, but what do you fill it with?
Soto, who's in recovery from drug and alcohol addiction, gave us a tour of the residence the city's provided to him free of charge.
I've been on and off the street for, 14 years. And in my situation, it was all due to substance abuse. I just like to get drunk a lot every day. And then before you know it, the lifestyle catches up and I'm one of the people on Skid Row or under a bridge.
Until newer housing comes online, homes like this are in very limited supply. Only veterans who've gone through a lengthy recovery process from substance abuse qualify for this building.
They treat us like trash.
For vet Willie Van Seals, who's still struggling with addiction, that seems like a distant prospect.
I went through rehab.
Okay.
And when I went through, they promised me, when I got through, that they would actually give me my voucher and I could go and find me a place to stay.
Okay.
And none of that happened. Okay. This is where I ended up at.
So did you manage to kick the habit in rehab?
Nah. America paints herself as a good Samaritan country. I'm glad the UN came here because you see third world conditions right here, you know, in the richest country in the world that's worse than other countries.
The United Nations report notwithstanding, there are other indications things may be improving for the homeless in LA. In 2016, Angelenos voted overwhelmingly for a tax increase directed at funding the creation of homes for the chronically homeless. And while tents still line the streets of Skid Row, this year, chronic homelessness has dropped 18% in L.A. County.
When it rains, you must have something on this floor.
But for Willie Van Seals and others like him, Los Angeles still has a long way to go.
This is the Rumor Report with Angela Yee. Rumor has it. On the Breakfast Club.
So listen up.
Well, according to reports...
Today we have organizations like the SBA making it easier for you to get into business. But 50 years ago, what do you think the odds would be that you could start your own small business and make it succeed?
The odds were against a black man succeeding in the business world, but John Johnson has never been one to look at the downside. He used $500, perseverance, faith, and family devotion to build an empire worth nearly $200 million. His name is now a legend in the world of publishing, fashion, beauty products, and broadcasting. John Johnson has a formula for taking what seems impossible and making it real. His story is an inspiration for people of all colors.
Well, I guess it just proves, in a continuing way, that there is opportunity there, that given the knowledge, the devotion, and the sacrifice, that success can come. So it ought to tell us that more young blacks ought to take a chance. I think, really, that in the past, when young blacks have gone to college, we have assumed that we did not get respect and prestige unless we went into the professions. I think now more and more that is changing. We're recognizing that money and success gives you prestige and recognition, even though it may come from selling hamburgers, it may come from selling barbecue, it may come from opening a grocery store or running a cleaning plant or any other thing. And I think as we move ahead and as those areas, the business area, gets more recognition, and more credibility, then I think more young people will go into it. Unfortunately, in the white corporate world as we know it today, there is a ceiling on how far blacks can go. There are rare exceptions, but by and large, the vice presidency is as far as you can go. Now, there are some of us who are not just temperamentally suited to be only vice president. We want to be presidents. We want to run things. We want to be in charge. For those people, I say, you've got to go out and start your own. And so I believe for people who are satisfied to be a vice president, perhaps in the long run, for people who want to work for someone else and to live under the fear now of mergers and buyouts, all of which jeopardize their security, if they want to live that way, fine. But if they really want to have a degree of security, a degree of fulfillment, if they want to make a contribution to the race as a whole, then I think they need to go out and start their own.
If you had to do it all over again today, what type of business would you go into?
If I was starting over again today, and if all the publications were in place that are in place today, I don't think I'd go into the publishing business. I think I'd be inclined to go into the service business, somewhere where you're rendering service. I might want to start my own chain of hamburger places. I still think it's very sad that we don't have barbecue franchises. I think we could develop cleaning establishment franchises. I think anything that would give service to the public would be a good thing to go into now. Because service is no longer important to people. You walk around and people are arrogant. They're insensitive. They don't want to serve. So I'd want to be in something where service would move me ahead.
What advice would you give a small business going after a larger client?
And I developed a simple philosophy. I said that I would call companies and they all wanted to refer me to the contributions department. And I say, no, I don't want a contribution. I want to give you something in return for your giving me something. I would always say that if the president of the smallest country in the world came to America, our president, as a matter of public policy and protocol, would see that president. And I said to the people, I am the president of a very small company, but I am the president. And I feel that as a matter of courtesy, your president ought to see me. Now, I have to say I was never turned down. I was put aside, I was delayed, but I was never turned down. And persistence went out. I think what you need more than anything else in going into business is persistence, a refusal to give up, a motivation to continue when everything looks like you ought to quit. And I think that's what entrepreneurs have to have.
How important is access to information to the small business person?
There's a great need for information. There are all kinds of people out there who are writing me letters and calling up with good ideas and wanting to know how to go into business. So I think if we had a national television show devoted to business development, it would be a great thing.
All right, and that was the late John H. Johnson, who published the originally the Negro Digest, which was the predecessor to Ebony and Jet magazine, which those publications no longer are in print form. However, unless you do it print on demand. But no longer available on the newsstands, but they're still in business. All right, anyway, I'll jump off topic before we go to our phone lines, 619-768-2945. We're just going to put it out here because we'll probably cover more in the detail throughout the week on this. Fire your utility company. Stop renting household energy and own it. Most people don't know this, but you can fire the electric company, you can fire the natural gas company, whoever comes to your house for that, and you can fire the water company, provided you know that you can set up your own private utility companies right within your own home. So throughout the week, we'll be talking about functional illiteracy, the definition of that, because most people when it comes to this are functionally illiterate. Household energy literacy, which will be our core throughout the week. Household energy illiteracy, which most people are, at least in the United States and Western countries. Household energy equity, which is what your local power companies tap into the household equity within your home. How to own your own electric company, how to own your own water company, how to own your own fuel company, backyard utilities, off-the-grid utilities, then things like solar sheds, solar carports, how to convert a shed into a home, and the concept of space versus time. That might change some of yours mindset. Anyway, let's go to the phone lines here real quick. Area code 612, your mic is open.
Hey, how you doing, bro? I just came in to pick up from the radio station. This is Shorter. I'm an invite through Chris. Wanted to get a chance to meet you, bro. I was on your show once before. We talked about trying to do the Homes Across America. I'm happened to be in the area. I happen to be in the area. I wanted to see if we might be able to get some things going with your property in Jacksonville that you was talking about.
Well, it's not in Jacksonville. It's about an hour and a half away from Jacksonville.
Oh, that's what I heard it wrong.
Right. Let's see. Okay. You're in Tampa or something like that, Tampa Bay area? I think you mentioned that yesterday.
Yeah, I'm in Tampa now.
Okay. Now, because I remember you calling some while ago. Give us your background again. I mean, interest.
My interest? Well, I do a lot of edutainment. I think the best way to reach people is through the education and entertainment field. I work together with putting together a music festival that happens to do a lot of education about blockchain technology, innovation and technology, digitech. We do solar, green energy, agricultural, things like that. Partnering with Chris, we're able to incorporate the tiny home or smart city development that we was doing on some projects with the ABA and some other organizations, and to continue to grow out from there with Chris and his Hope for America, where we also came across trying to do some work in Hawaii while they're going through their rebuild.
Okay. All right, now you said what do you call it? Edutainment.
Edutainment, right?
Okay, now give me an example of that. I mean, I've heard of that term. That's what they have a lot of that on YouTube. But what would be some of your versions of that?
Mine would be a gathering of people where we come together. And we get educated and get some education and in person, like I call IRL interaction and engagement with community or citizens or people who wanted to bring to learn more about several different subjects in which I just listed, whether it be agriculture, digitech, the blockchain, NFT technology, how to incorporate wealth or start to build generational wealth. Being able to scale their business, being able to take advantage of digital marketing, how to get better associated with AI, all these different types of things that we would be able to bring people's awareness towards these different subjects and niches, at the same time provide them some type of entertainment that might be in the entertainment field that they're more interested in also, such as gaming and doing things inside of the digital world and the robotics world. Also doing AR, VR, metaverse-type gaming. We can also do the entertainment where it comes as far as music, fashion, and also doing even culinary arts inside of these things. So we can do a digital fashion show. We can do an in-person fashion show. We can do a music festival. We can do a gaming competition. We even got professional athletic teams that want to try to do like NASCAR racing. And I'm not saying NASCAR is involved, but some type of racing games that are done inside of the metaverse. So it's all about It's all about educating and reaching people where they're at, but also entertaining them in the field that they're also very comfortable with.
Okay. Now, are you on WhatsApp?
One more again?
Are you on WhatsApp?
I'm on WhatsApp with several different groups and organizations. I don't have my own WhatsApp chat group.
No, but like your 612 number, is that on WhatsApp?
Yes.
Okay,
yes.
I'm gonna add you on to my number here. Give me your first name again.
Everybody calls me Shorter, bro.
Shorter. Okay, Shorter.
Yeah, military brat. Just use my last name as my personal reference.
Okay. All right, I'm going to add that. Okay, wait a minute. I'm going to send you a quick note. And you're from up in Minnesota, right?
Yeah.
Yeah,
yes, sir.
What part of Minnesota are you coming from?
I live in downtown Minnesota. Minneapolis. I'm sorry, downtown Minneapolis. My bad. I was speaking like those people from Chicago who act like Chicago's the only place in Illinois. You know what I mean? I'm from the...
Now, I've heard about North Minnesota, not North Minnesota, the north side of Minnesota. What's the deal with up there?
You talking about north side
of
Minneapolis?
North side of the city of Minneapolis. Yeah, Minneapolis.
Yeah. So north side of Minneapolis is a predominantly black area. It's historically, that's where all the black history is done in Minneapolis. It also has a lot of gang affiliations. It was the murder capital of the United States at one time.
I know people like Prince, Andre Simone, those type people. That's I've heard reference to it in terms of those guys. Yeah.
So Prince, as a young man, he stayed in North Minneapolis, and then when his family became, when he was a teenager, then he moved over to the South Side. But he has a lot of family, friends, and things like that over in the North Side. Once a North Sider, you're always a North Sider. The high school just won a national championship not too long ago. They lost one of their star quarterbacks in a senseless identity type shooting type thing.
Right.
We have done a lot of development in that area since the killing of George, the murder of George Floyd, which happened in South Minneapolis. But over in the north side, we've done a lot of unification, a lot of black awareness. We've had some major development in the money as far as business growth, collaboration, and community involvement, and that's really all over the Minneapolis area. We have some Grammy Award bands that are doing some musical events that are in there. We got Pee Wee Dread that does the agricultural drive there with Dread Eye Dread is the name of that group. I'm trying to put all the musical people in mind. Wow, I can't put all those people in right now. But, yeah, we have a lot of things that are going in there. Right now I'm working on with the Juneteenth committee so that we can put on a very large granular event next year for Juneteenth, following along with the other events that happened before Pride. Yeah, we're definitely trying to make some marks in North Minneapolis.
Now, and further up in the state of
Minnesota,
like what St. Louis County, places like or Cass County, St. Louis County and Lake County. What Duluth is in one of those counties.
I wouldn't know the counties. I would know the cities. I don't know the counties.
Well, yeah, Duluth. What do you know about Duluth?
Duluth is just for me. It's north of Minneapolis. It's a port harbor town. You know what I'm saying? It's a connection to Lake Superior. That's where they get a lot of import and export from Minnesota goes out of the Duluth area. Heavily populated with a Somalian culture that's moving up there. But the entire area is all Native. So
okay.
I don't really know too much about business and export there.
I know it gets real cold up there. What was that movie? It's right off the tip of my tongue. Part
Fargo.
Of it took place in Minnesota. That's
Fargo.
It. You
talking about Fargo
man,
or the Denzel Washington movie?
Is Brainerd in North? I mean, not North. Is that in North Dakota or Minnesota? Brainerd
is in Minnesota.
Yeah.
It's in Minnesota.
Okay. I knew somebody that lived in Brainerd. It was like a chat, but oh man, it's 15, 20 years ago. Well, that's one place I've been. I got to get up there one day.
Brainerd's where a lot of people go for fishing and hunting.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I think the movie Grumpy Old Men was shot there.
All right. Now, what about rural land throughout the state? Affordable prices, or what's the deal? Because I know Minnesota's got a lot of rural land.
Yeah, it. Some of it's affordable. It's a fair playground. They're starting to find a lot of different ores and minerals inside of the land.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why some people are holding on to their land. But at the same time, the state
right.
of Minnesota just gave a bunch of land back to the natives from old treaties. So they
okay,
gave
well,
thousands.
That's quite a bit of land.
Thousands of acres.
I imagine they have a matter of fact, I'm looking that up now. Native American reservation.
Mystic Lake is one of the largest casinos in the United States. It's out there in South Minneapolis in Shakopee, in South Minnesota.
Oh, that's right. I guess some years ago, she has a cousin who's Native American, and they have a casino. It's not too. It could be in the metro area of Minneapolis, St. Paul, if I remember. But
well, yeah, they have buses that does.
She makes enough money from the tribe. She doesn't even work for the tribe directly. She gets a check.
Correct.
She was able,
related.
You know. Yeah, she's related, and she gets a check, and it's well, it pays for her house. That's all I know.
Yeah, some of those people get more than what people make in a lifetime. I'm sorry, in a full year's pay, some of those people are getting it every month. I know some natives that are getting
that's
like $90,000 a month.
A month?
A month.
I need to get, because when I had her cousin on, I didn't have her on. But, I had an opportunity once. I would have to get back in touch with these people. They were up in, Montana. And they invited me up to their reservation. That's the one where I would, because I'm interested in solar energy and all that type of stuff, too. The entrepreneur, if you catch them on entrepreneurial tip, trucking systems, casinos, accommodations.
Agriculture, import and export of agricultural goods. Entertainment, and right now they're because of them getting their land, they're going to start to go into the hemp hemp industry.
Okay. All right. Well, what I'll do is I'll give you a call like this afternoon offline you know, what I got going here, like the place which is like 90 minutes away from east. No, not east, because that'll put you in the Atlantic Ocean. West of Jacksonville. And okay. About a half hour away from Valdosta, Georgia. It's about 3 hours away from, no, I'd say the Tampa Bay area.
Okay.
I'm going north. So I'll give you a call. But I got you locked into my WhatsApp, and I just sent you a quick note on that, too, about 2 or 3 minutes ago. So.
All right. We'll definitely connect
And anything going on in Minnesota that you wanted to promote?
Well, whatever I'm doing, I can do in any area. I have some land in Minnesota that I'm trying to utilize for the education purpose, the edutainment purpose. We're doing some music festivals on those properties. We're also doing some demonstrations of the tiny homes that Chris builds. We're also going to do the promotion. We're going to do the promotion of solar energy, agricultural development, hydroponics, being able to do all of the things that you was mentioning earlier that your show is going to be about. We cover a lot of that.
All right, good. All right, Shorter, good. Thank you for calling in, and I'll give you a call in a few hours.
All right, bro.
Morning people wake up for peace and quiet. McDonald's breakfast people, we wake up for the sweet rush of getting that warm, delicious breakfast right before it ends.
Crush your morning goals with a steak, egg, and cheese bagel or any breakfast sandwich and snag another one for just $1 with the buy one, get one deal. Only in the McDonald's app. Limited time only at participating McDonald's. Valid once per day. Must opt into rewards.
Ba-da-ba-ba-ba.
At Jiffy Lube, we car about cars. In fact, we're kind of obsessed. That's why we've been taking care of business with quick quality oil changes and service for over 40 years. And with things like our Carful Vehicle Review, where our experts will check, fill, clean, and inspect your vehicle, you'll know we'll car for your car like we car for our own. Jiffy Lube. Car more.
Visit JiffyLubeDC.com to find a Jiffy Lube service center near you.